Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc, in for Joe Donahue, since I know that many of you out there worry when Joe isn't here. Scheduled day off. Personal days are allowed. Don't worry about that. You don't have to worry about Joe today. He's doing all right. He's doing great, even, as far as I know. The email...
Sarah, that's great. It's like, oh my God, Sarah's here. The response isn't, oh good, Sarah's here. The response is, what happened to Joe?
It is. But he's the regular host, so, you know, that's to be expected. But yes, when I started hosting, I did apologize that it was me. I don't do that anymore. I'm just telling everybody that Joe's fine. Don't worry about him. We're going to have a great show today. The email address to join the conversation is panel@wamc.org. And our panel this morning, our communications expert and founder and president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore, whose voice you just heard. Good morning, Bob. Thanks
Good
for
morning,
being here.
Good morning, everybody. Yeah.
Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Hello, another Bob. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Good. Nice to be here today. I'm bracing myself for more winning on the economy today.
Great. Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, is here. Good morning, Nick. Hi.
Good morning, Bob. Made me giggle, but...
That's allowed.
And just a note, views are my own.
Views are your own. That's right.
And it's great to be here. Thanks, everyone.
Of course. And also... returning to the show, our Cory Booker correspondent, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson. Hi, Sarah. It's good to see you.
True story. I've known Cory since 2000. The year 2000.
It's 25 years?
2001. Yeah.
So many years.
I'm 24 years.
So I haven't been on for a little while, but I could not resist.
Thank you for coming
to
in.
To talk today.
We appreciate that. I want to point out that the Trump administration has designated today Liberation Day. There will be a 4 p.m. event in the Rose Garden that is intended to officially announce a lot of tariffs that are going to be enacted. But until we've been talking about it coming up a lot, but until the actual announcement happens, I don't think we have much more to say on the program today. So I anticipate they will talk about that tomorrow, but I didn't want to ignore it happening lest we get, you know, called to the carpet for ignoring it happening.
I just want to say thanks so much to the administration for freeing my dollars from my bank account. I will miss them dearly, but I'm happy to say goodbye.
Before we don't talk about this, does anybody else want to say anything?
I'm impressed that the Rose Garden is still standing, because wasn't that one of the first things that was going to go? Mm. They're going to turn it into a parking lot or something, yeah, a la Sheryl
Crow. Because
ballroom.
Yeah, good use of taxpayers' dollars.
Yeah.
Put up a Ferris wheel, maybe.
That would be fitting.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. So again, we're not going to discuss the tariffs at length today, but
it's a spicy panel.
It will be, and that is fine. But it will be, I imagine, a major topic for tomorrow's program. When it just so happens Joe returns and he can handle it. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. I also want to point out, before we do discuss Cory Booker's long, very long speech on the Senate floor, that on Saturday, this Saturday evening, Joe Donahue will be in conversation with Chris Hayes at the Bardavon in Poughkeepsie, New York, discussing his book, The Siren's Call. Bardavon.org for more information about that. Last I knew, there were tickets available. And again, that's this coming Saturday evening, bardavon.org. Let us discuss events on the Senate floor that started Monday night and ended last night. The former mayor of Newark, U.S. Senator since 2013 and 2020 presidential campaign candidate who primaried Joe Biden, Cory Booker, a New Jersey senator, ended his record-setting speech the same way he began it more than 25 hours earlier by invoking the words of his mentor, the late congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis. This is, quote, quoting Cory Booker, quoting John Lewis, says, he endured beating savagely on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, at lunch counters, on freedom rides. He said he had to do something and he would not normalize a moment like this. He would not just go along with business as usual. He said for us to go out and cause some good trouble, necessary trouble, to redeem the soul of our nation. That's Cory Booker quoting the late John Lewis. A break from business as usual was what Booker had in mind as he performed a feat of political endurance, holding the Senate floor for 25 hours and 5 minutes while delivering a wide-ranging critique of President Donald Trump and his policies. In doing so, Senator Booker broke the record for the longest Senate floor speech, a mark that had belonged for decades to Strom Thurmond, the avowed segregationist from South Carolina who filibustered the Civil Rights Act of 1957. Throughout his speech, he read letters from Americans about the impact of Trump's agenda that Trump's agenda, is having on their lives, drawing historical parallels and warnings that the country faces a looming constitutional crisis. Booker's speech captured attention at a time when Democrats have grown frustrated and despondent at their inability to stop Trump's plans. Locked out of power in Congress and the executive branch, Democrats have struggled with how to take on Trump and slashing government being carried out by Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency. It was not officially or technically a filibuster because it wasn't preventing something from being passed. It was a 25-hour showing of concerns and sharing of constituent concerns. And we are going to talk about it this morning. Who would like to begin? Nick.
I feel like Cory Booker
correspondent.
Correspondent should start.
Okay, go ahead,
Sarah
Rogerson.
I mean, this is classic Cory, and it's not performative. You know, you worry about those types of things. Like, the big question is this going to do anything, right? Obviously. It already has. So this is not something that he does lightly. It was pretty clear that it was pre-planned. There were a lot of participants. There were some organic moments, too, with people coming into the Senate to observe. But, you know, his mom was there. His cousin was there. His brother was there. And all of the Democrats in the Senate had a role to play. Yeah. They all had a
Chris
topic.
Murphy was ready with long questions so he could catch his breath.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been critical of the Democrats for a while. Well, forever. I think it's our job, too. And so this was good. I have to hand it to the Democrats, because the trick is to capture the American imagination right now and to remind us who we are. And a lot of people are not seeing that in this administration. A lot of people who voted for Trump are not seeing that in this administration, because what he's doing is not what he said he would do. Surprise, surprise. So the Democrats went to the heart of this country and they asked Cory to do it, which is not a surprise. Cory in Newark went on a 3-day hunger strike. I think it was 3 days to draw attention to housing issues in Newark just before I met him. So he doesn't do things performatively. He is a statesman's statesman or statesperson's statesperson. He did go to Yale, like our current vice president, but had a very different experience there. He does have a Rhodes Scholarship, but it's in feminist studies. I mean, like, this Cory's always been the real deal. When I met him, he was a city councilman, and I met him at a Black Law Students Association dinner dance at Seton Hall Law School, where I went to school. And my constitutional law professor, Mark Alexander, introduced me to him. And I saw him give his keynote speech in the basement of a Portuguese restaurant in the Ironbound of Newark. And I was like, I will follow that man wherever he goes. Mm. And for a big part of my career, I did. I don't know why his presidential campaign didn't get more traction. Well, I do know why. It's not a good explanation, but it's that Democrats rallied around Joe Biden out of fear, because, you know, the other candidates that were primarying former President Biden were all diverse candidates, quote unquote. So I felt like it was a return. It's fitting, a return to our values in the Senate. It's very fitting that Cory chose this moment to break this record of Strom Thurmond, one of the most regrettable figures in American Senate history, and chose that to be the focal point to bring this message to the American people. Is it nerdy and was it on C-SPAN? Yes, but I think TikTok and our intergenerational colleagues are going to do some magic with that 25 hours of footage and make it relatable to the American people.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, you know, Sarah, it's interesting because I just completely disagree. Notwithstanding the elements of Senator Booker, I expected more from him than this. You know, those kooky Democrats, what are they going to do next? Like, how many senators can we fit in a phone booth? What happened yesterday does not move the conversation at all. It drives home again the fact that the Democrats don't have an answer, and they're grasping at straws. And it left me feeling actually angrier and angrier at the Democratic leadership than it did before, which I didn't think I could get there that quickly. It did have an impact. It did push back a vote where Tim Kaine had enough votes, including some crossovers from the Republican Party, to seek to block the tariffs on Canada. So it did have an impact on legislation. And you know, Sarah, you say it's not performative, and I'm sorry, I got to say Sarah 1, Sarah 2 here because it's the multiple Sarahs.
Just assume you're not talking to me.
Yeah, it just feels performative, though. It really does. It just feels like it's a gimmick, and I'm tired of the gimmicks. I'm tired of Congress. I'm tired of Congress not acting. We're going to have at least 15 more times in the conversation today where we're going to ask ourselves, or our listeners are going to ask us, where's the congressional oversight? And that's not what I saw. So I'm very disappointed. I'm very disappointed in the games as usual, and it left me really questioning the thought process that went into it.
I think both things are true. I think by nature of giving a 25-hour speech, it is performative because it is a political performance, and it didn't impact or have an effect on a vote or a bill or legislation. I also think that it was impactful. I think the number was 350 million likes on TikTok Live. That's a tremendous audience that typically doesn't even know what Congress is or like what the chambers look like, and have never been on C-SPAN. And I do think that between Cory Booker and also the several conversations that AOC is having and Bernie Sanders are having, there is sort of a reset happening, a sort of moral calling to voters to think differently about what they want to get out of their politicians and out of their elections. Do I think it's anywhere near enough? Absolutely not. Have the Democrats actually changed how they think about voters? No, unfortunately. I experienced frustration even in the state of New York, where we have New York City voters coming to the Capitol for conferences, but the conference doesn't include speakers from upstate New York or anywhere from outside of New York City. And you're like, well, why are, like, we're in Albany, it's the Capitol. Like, why aren't we connecting with voters here? We're only bringing voters up from downstate, and then they're like isolated into like two hotels. You know, it's like this really weird, and it's like, you know, there's like people of color in Albany too, actually. And there's Hispanic folks here, imagine, right? So like, we're not changing how we think about our voters or our voter base. We're not engaging with a broader scope of voters. But I think it's a helpful place to reset and say, look, we need to think differently about what we think democracy is supposed to be and what we expect from our government. And we can start here. I mean, there's plenty of time to do more. And I think it's good to start here now instead of waiting to see how much more devastation can be brought on Americans and the world, it turns out. Everybody else.
Bob Bellafiore.
Well, a couple of things. This isn't a knock on Cory Booker. Of course it was performative.
I should have said solely performative. Oh, okay.
It was totally performative. I don't know Cory for 25 years, but I watched him a lot. There was a time in his life when he was a big supporter of an issue I care deeply about, which is school choice and charter schools. I watched him on Twitter leaving his house with his shovel to dig out somebody's snowed-in car in Newark and all of those things. It's not a knock on him. All of American politics is performative, and that is a fundamental, foundational problem. I am dying to see somebody who looks and sounds like Quasimodo be a national presidential candidate. We don't get it. Everything is, are they telegenic? Do they look good on TV? Can they deliver the lines? It is, we have, American culture has said, we love entertainers. So what do you think our politicians are going to become? And lo and behold, what we have in the White House is somebody who was an entertainer, right?
And elites, really. I mean, aside from Donald Trump, everybody else is an elite. We forget that Pete Hegseth went to Princeton. Our vice president went to Yale. These are not like salt of the earth people.
Well, you hardly ever, the last sort of working class guy we had in the White House was Clinton, was Bill. So it's, you know, politics elevates the elite. It's just the way it is, right? But it's become completely performative. And what that is, it was a 24-25 hour performance. I think what it indicates, and Nick, you kind of got to this a little bit, is Democrats have more than a messaging problem. I saw a quote from the head of the DNC the other day. We have the right message, just it's not linking with voters. That is by definition the wrong message.
Yeah, right.
Right? So Democrats for years have tried to tell people what to think instead of aligning with figuring out where they are and going there, which is why on all these 80-20 issues, the Democratic Party is hugging the 20. And that is a fundamental mistake that is misaligned with where the American public is. And I don't know that what you heard from Cory, I don't know what anybody heard from Cory Booker. I'll say, if his goal is 350 million likes on TikTok, knock yourself out. That is not the way to convince the American public. Because if you look at those 350 million likes on TikTok, what do you think the average engagement with that speech was? 30 seconds? 30? Now, what's the percent? I'm not a mathematician. I'm an English major. But what is the percentage of 30 seconds versus 25 hours? Right? And I think my third point is there are a lot easier ways to declare you're running for president in 2028.
He didn't do that.
Of course he did that. That's exactly what he did. He tried to say that he is the messenger. He is the person who can carry the message. He is Spartacus. He's the guy who can carry the message to the American public about what Democrats stand for.
I think it's important to note that he was asked by leadership. If somebody was going to run for president, it would look very, very differently. 1,000% differently. The possibility of him screwing that up, and he didn't for 25 hours. And yeah, I am biased. He is my friend. But he did something very different than what we've seen lately from this party. It was incomplete. It was actually beautifully imperfect in some ways. But it did capture imaginations in ways that haven't before. I think people did engage with it more than your standard C-SPAN Senate speech. And I think what he did by focusing on voters and the letters that they sent in was to try to say, we're listening to you. And that's important.
We will hear listener letters and then return to this topic after a news break from the BBC. We'll be back after this. Quiet on the set. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke. The panel this morning, Bob Bellafiore, Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, Sarah Rogerson, and me, Sarah LaDuke. That's two Sarahs, two Bobs, and one Nick. You're the tiebreaker. You're the ref.
That's a great band name.
Maybe.
We should go on the road.
Does anybody play an instrument? Bob Bellafiore, I had to cut you off to take a break.
Oh, the in politics, you can do a great thing on a day, but then it's what's next.
Totally.
Right? Like in pro football, I had a 9-yard gain on first down, right? Still not, you're still second and one, then it can be third and one, then it can be fourth and one. It's always what you do next. So are people going to engage with this? Well, you know, let's see. The Democratic Party has been flailing, mostly because they can't believe they lost it. It's like the old John Lovitz skit on Saturday Night Live where he's playing Mike Dukakis and he's debating George H.W. Bush and goes, I can't believe I'm losing to this guy. Mm-hmm. Right? They yep. can't believe they're losing to this guy. And until they have a serious reflective look of what happened, they're going to continue to be into this. And Nick, when you say AOC and Bernie, the Republican Party would pay to have AOC and Bernie do more rallies across the country. Because if the Democrats think their move is to go to hug the left more, to hug progressivism more, to hug these 20% issues more, then they're going to be in the woods for a lot longer time than they think.
I want to talk a little bit about a couple of things. And this will be the sort of like the last, probably the last personal note that I'll share. But there, Corey isn't new, but there is a new senator from Michigan. Her name's Alyssa Slotkin. Mm-hmm. She's a veteran. She is. I've come to know her through a tragedy in my family, and she and Corey shared that. So I don't know if the other Bob knows this, but my nephew is a surviving victim of the Oxford, Michigan school shooting. And, you know, when we talk about messages and we talk about things like that, you know, it could have been another school shooting that no one would remember. But a couple of things changed that. One was a really brave district attorney in Oakland County who decided to charge the parents because the parents engaged, the father engaged in an allegedly illegal straw sale at a firearms dealer that was licensed in Oxford, Michigan, where my sister and my nephews live. When Eli was shot in the face, and we weren't sure where he was or what was happening next, and when my family was sort of thrust into this national spotlight, there were two people that reached out to our family. Alyssa Slotkin, who at the time was not a senator, but she represents my family in their district, and her lead staffer, just the whole team was really, really phenomenal. And the governor's office, of course, Governor Whitmer, who I love, Big Gretch. I will love her forever. I'm very sad. This is her last term. I'm very excited for her to run for president. But the other person that called me was Cory Booker. I hadn't spoken to Cory in over a decade. And he found my number. I don't know how he got it, the magic of being in the federal government. And he called me personally to tell me that he cared about what happened, that he was sorry for what happened. And I had my sister play that for my nephew who was in the hospital. And he watched Corey's statements last night. That matters. That kind of leadership matters. Those stories aren't told. That wasn't the end. A couple of days later, I sent the GoFundMe page for my nephew to my friends on this everybody who works in Booker politics in Newark, we still kind of try to stay in touch with each other. So I sent it to that email group. And through that network, I found out 24, 48 hours later that Corey had actually shared the GoFundMe page with his presidential list. That's a big deal. It's not because we're friends. Friends is like a stretch at this point. I've known him for that long. I've followed his career for that long. I don't talk to him all the time. The last time I spoke to him was that day. And I actually let it go to voicemail because it was from an unknown number and I wasn't answering unknown calls. So that's great because I have it on voicemail. And like that kind of leadership from Alyssa and from Corey around my family. And it wasn't just my family. Because I think that's another problem, is this American exceptionalism and American individualism that we can't get out of our own heads. Like, what's in it for me? What's in it for my family? How do I keep my family safe? I asked Alyssa if she would have any resources, federal resources, that she could pull around for the first responders, because I knew that they would experience vicarious trauma. Because one of the kids who died in a sheriff's deputy police vehicle, and I knew that that would be extremely traumatic, not just for the family, of course, and not for the classmates, but for that officer. And she did. She rallied around. She found pots of funding to help support mental health services for the first responders to that emergency, and then went further to figure out, you know, how do we set up emergency networks? Other Bob, you're an expert on this, but like, how do we set up blueprints for responding to these types of situations? And furthermore, how do we prevent them? So I've gone on for a bit, but I just want to differentiate why I experienced and why I think a lot of Americans experienced who tuned in and listened that speech last night as something different. And it's because it was authentic, because it's meaningful, because it's trying to recenter the Democratic Party around the values that Americans share and haven't really found a language to talk about yet. That's the next message. And the Democrats are trying to get there by elevating these different leaders But it's going to be, it's a big tent party. It's a big tent conversation. It's a big tent family. And we're all going to fight about it.
The sad part of, multiple sad parts of this conversation, I feel like we're less safe today from school shootings than we were. All of the work that you just talked about, the idea of both the mental health issues for first responders, is wiped out by what I believe is the illegal DOGE process.
Yeah.
And when you look at the plethora of issues today that we could talk about, whether it's the massacre of leadership in our federal health agencies, whether it's the fact that we deported somebody illegally to El Salvador and now we can't get that person back, whether it's the mental midgets running our national security that use Gmail. We thought Signal was bad. Gmail is even worse. I mean, there are so many of these issues, and the line I draw back is that the balance to incompetent and inept administration was supposed to be congressional oversight, right? So the balance on the executive was supposed to be primarily the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. The courts, Congress, and the president, right? And I think about, we're talking about a 25-hour speech when we've got all of these other issues, and I just feel like it's taking away from the very fact that our government is being ruined from the inside, so that even when the actions that I believe the courts will take that will invalidate what is occurring, the damage will be so severe that it won't be able to be repaired. I mean, the whole story about the illegal deportation to El Salvador is to me such a microcosm of where this country is, because what's happening is that like that poor man and the family that is suffering now and will suffer for the rest of their lives from this. Our government and our government agencies are being illegally deported, and they won't be able to be returned. So there's a lot of issues on the table today.
I mean, I do think that Corey's speech could help create a focal point where I think many people are sort of flailing about and bouncing from tragedy to tragedy or trauma to trauma, where being distracted by all the flood the zone approach to policy and communications. What I think we need to be conscious or thoughtful about is, does it then lead to a new and better and informed election strategy? So I don't think there's anything wrong with Cory Booker having a very performative speech that creates lots of engagement. And I think it could be a really positive turning point for the party if they tie it together with a different approach to elections, to messaging, to connecting with voters that they've had a historical challenge with connecting with. Because I haven't seen, in all of the analysis of why Democrats lost to Trump, I haven't seen anyone take any action to change the way they're engaging with the voters that every analyst has said the Democratic Party lost, right? And I think that's the next step. And I don't know today if yesterday's speech has also this election strategy tied to it, or that there's something more to it. I hope it is. I think it would be helpful to the party to engage those voters differently. But that's the piece, that's the missing piece. It's not that it should be only one thing. It needs to be multi-step strategy. And like I said, I think it's a good time to start that because we needed to start it a year ago.
A billion years ago.
And I think, 200 you know,
years ago.
Like, yeah. For, yeah, right. But like, better now than never, I guess. And, well, but that's the piece I'm looking for is like, that's great. You did a thing. I love it. But like, now what? And that now what needs to be powerful because I'm going to be really disappointed.
Well, and there's a difference between performative and performance. So it was a performance. I don't think it was performative because he didn't stand up in the middle of a live session, actually filibuster something that doesn't really matter, and then do it on his own. It was orchestrated. So that means that the Democratic Party understands that they have to do something next. I mean, these are really smart people, presumably.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's fine.
So go ahead. No, this is perfect for
you. Yeah. No, I was going to say, Nick, you are 1,000% right.
Right. I love those words.
1,000% right?
Yes.
No, just record it on a list.
Just say that all the time.
Make it your ringtone.
No, just think it's 1,000%.
My mom's listening, by the way.
Hi, Mom. Nick, Mom, I just want to say, I never sit here in the studio and say anybody else in this room is 1,000% right. I have only ever said it for Nick. So whatever you did.
Well, you're relatively new, though.
Wow, Sarah.
No. See, that's not what I mean.
Sarah's got issues maybe are above our pay grade. but it, you know, you are exactly right. Cory Booker's speech, right? Anybody baseball fans in the room? You can win a game 20
not to speak of.
You can win a game 20-0 on Monday, and then on Tuesday lose 2-0. Right? A momentum in baseball, they say momentum is the next day's starting pitcher. Right? So he had this great speech. That's fine. I don't think, unless the Democrats figure out how to package this and how to turn this into a strategy and how to figure out a way to resonate with where voters are, then this is going to be a one day story and no one's going to remember anything in a week about it. Right? And that is the hard work of politics. Sarah, you said we're like an angry family and we're a big tent and we're always fighting with each other, right? They used to say, oh, they're acting like Democrats again, right, which is circular firing squad. Mm-hmm. Unless they honestly figure out what happened and why they are in such misalignment with where the American public is, until they decide to get off of the 20% of these 80-20 issues, right, and start focusing on what matters to the American people, whatever it may be, then they're going to sit there and go lost and go, they're going to be, John Lovett's going, I can't believe I lost to this guy. Because it's going to be, they are refusing to look in the mirror and be self-reflective.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We have been ourselves creating engagement as the conversation has gone on. We do have many emails to read, but first we need to take a break. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Our panelists this morning, communications expert and founder and president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson. We do have listener email sent to panel@wamc.org. Matt Roden. Oh, sorry, Nick.
I do just want to say happy birthday to my niece.
Okay.
Her name is also Sarah.
Yay.
Happy birthday, Sarah. How old?
She's 9.
9. It's a fun age.
Fellow Aries. My birthday's tomorrow.
Happy birthday tomorrow.
Thank you.
Matt wrote in to panel@wamc.org and said, I wish Senator Booker was filibustering something, but he wasn't. He made a great effort, made great points, but purposefully chose not to actually disrupt anything. I do think it's performative. What did it really do? Democrats seem good at making big gestures when they're practice and pull the punches when we need them or when they need to land them. Sorry, when they need to land them. That's from Matt. Catherine says, if you listen to what he was saying and were not moved, he being Cory Booker, perhaps there is a barrel from which to speak that has your name on it. We heard from Kathy who says, so what is performative? Is there any value? Is being a panelist on WAMC's roundtable performative?
1,000%. Mm-hmm.
And other things and important.
It is 100% performative. That's because it's radio. Right? And we're not doing anything. We're the Peanut Gallery. Peanut Gallery is by definition performative.
Great. I would consider this like analysis and engagement with information as opposed to like a performance, though.
I'm trying to find another email so we can get off of this one. I know. Sorry.
So you can get us to shut up.
Not shut up. Just talk about something else.
You know, I think like Corey's like speech had, I'll give you more time. It had a lot of content. It had depth. Mm-hmm. It was reading letters from constituents. It was discussing the like criminal justice systems and the impact it has on
and what
communities.
Doge was doing.
It's
and
talking about what Doge is doing and how that impacts people. I think that's information sharing with people who are tuning in for the moments that they're tuning in. I think there was a lot of information that maybe people aren't consuming elsewhere, as most of us desperately avoid the news cycle. And it kind of tied things together in a way, I think, that or helped weave a story that some people may be having a hard time tying together. They're seeing these sort of separate and maybe the issues that are popping up as like not contiguous or not related to each other. And I think parts of his speech helped kind of tie them together and say these things are a patchwork and they may be separate for individual people, but together there's a story that needs to be told. And I think he spent a fair amount of time telling that story.
25 hours. Like what was that at hour 15 or 16 that they said? And here's my issue, Sarah. Let's go back to something that's been said a couple of times. This was done sort of with the support and understanding of the leadership. Okay. Again, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. The leadership is flailing. Okay. They didn't know how to handle the government shutdown. All right. This feels in some respects like, you know, like Booker was sent up there to try to hide the fact that the Democratic leadership in the Senate misrepresented or misunderstood what its base was trying to tell it. Okay, and this is just another piece of they don't know where they're going. Okay, and I appreciate all of the, you know, all of the potentially wonderful sound bites out of a 25-hour speech. I just don't see how that has helped the cause, or frankly helped where we are as a country.
Linda writes in and says, come on, quit bashing the speech by Cory Booker. I was moved. I was in tears to hear him speaking for me. Performative, yes, so what? I needed that performance as much as I needed a win in Wisconsin, and we got both. Life has been hard under Trump, and I was happy to hear him speak so well, to hear Cory speak so well. It felt like the sun came out for a short while. Why the circular firing squad?
Bob, hearing what you're saying is so much the message that the Democrats need to hear, is that it can't be a one-shot deal, and where in the 25 hours is the message darts, right? Like things I always say about messaging is diffuse messaging is like throwing BBs against the wall, little marbles against the wall. They hit the wall and they make a lot of noise and then they scatter. Effective messaging has to be a dart. Right, where you throw it and it sticks and you hit your target.
So what is the message? What is the message that the Democrats should be rallying around? What is the thing?
Well,
the economy right now. I would be nailing the economy. I'd be nailing the fact that you're in worse shape today than you were in January.
I think that's too flighty. Like that like comes in and out, and people, I don't think there's enough people feeling that in there at the kitchen table yet to change their opinion about how and who they voted for. It's starting. I think the lack of access to Social Security benefits will be a real pivotal moment, but today, until Trump liberates all my dollars from my pocketbook, that's not enough to change the trajectory of the next round of elections.
He's been president for 78 days, right? The economics never works fast enough for the politics to be satisfied. So in many ways, you know, the James Carville strategy is sit back and wait. This guy will eventually set himself on fire. In the meantime, you know, that's a hard strategy for people to implement because, one, you don't know You know, Trump could have a course correction. He's got to have a course correction on a lot of things. He's going way too fast and people are being way too sloppy about too many things that hurt. He's lost Joe Rogan and Ann Coulter on the Maryland migrant. You lose those guys, like, it's time for you to reassess how fast you're going.
I'd be happy to lose Joe Rogan and Ann Coulter too, but they're not my people.
But that's the point.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris doesn't go on Joe Rogan's show, and it costs her because he is the avenue to millions of ears and hearts and minds.
I think he did. I mean, it's known that he intentionally created an environment that was not actually intended to bring Kamala Harris onto his show. So that, you know, that was performative. And as much as Joe Rogan's like turned on Trump on a specific thing, he hasn't turned on the administration. He is still quite the fanboy of Elon Musk.
Okay.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. I wanted to read, oh, this letter. From Chris, who says, according to Bob Bellafiore, no one will remember Senator Booker's filibuster in a week. Funny how people still refer to Strom Thurmond's filibuster so many years later. The point of Senator Booker's speech was that we are facing a very dangerous, unprecedented threat from within our own country. As Trump continues to unravel our government, Senator Booker's filibuster will become more relevant to all concerned Americans. That is from Chris in Saratoga Springs.
But only if it's followed by action.
Yep.
Can I reply to my neighbor Chris in Saratoga Springs?
Quickly.
Nobody's heard of Strom Thurmond's filibuster until yesterday. It was out of the minds of
people. What? Nobody. I know about it, and I don't know anything.
I'm going to say very few people. Right, are aware of Strom, except when the civil rights, it's part of a history lesson. The second thing is Lee Miringoff, who's a pollster at Marist College, who is a brilliant man who I've known for decades.
Friend of the station.
Yes, would say that if a politician is working to secure his or her base, that's a problem.
I think we've known that we've been in that problem for some time, though.
Right, because what Trump has been able to do is peel off aspects of the Democratic base that the Democrats had taken for granted.
Sure.
And I don't know how many voters.
We're up
voters.
Against a newscast, y'all.
Oh,
sorry.
I mean, there are other things happening.
There are other things happening and other topics we have to get to, which we will after this news break with Ray Graft. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, joined by Bob Bellafiore, Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, and Sarah Rogerson. We are now going to discuss the Maryland man, this is from the New York Times, who is in the United States legally and was deported to El Salvador and imprisoned there because of an administrative error. Trump administration officials said in a court filing on Monday that the American courts lacked the jurisdiction to have him released. The man, Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia, has lived in the United States under protected legal status since October of 2019. His wife and 5-year-old child are both U.S. citizens. On March 12th, Mr. Abrego Garcia was stopped by immigration agents who told him inaccurately that his status had changed, according to court documents. Mr. Abrego Garcia had withholding from removal status, which means he was the subject of a deportation order, but was allowed to stay in the United States because of the likelihood that he could be harmed if he returned to El Salvador. 3 days later, Mr. Abrego Garcia was deported to El Salvador. He is now being held in its terrorism confinement center, so-called mega prison known as CECOT. In the court filing, Trump administration officials said there was nothing they could do to correct the error, given that Abrego Garcia was no longer in U.S. custody. During a briefing at the White House yesterday, Caroline Leavitt, Mr. Trump's spokeswoman, defined the deportation of Mr. Abrego Garcia, telling reporters the administration had evidence that he was a convicted member of the Salvadoran street gang MS-13, even though he has never gone to trial or pleaded guilty. In Monday's court filing, administration officials balked at the request to return him, claiming that U.S. courts did not have jurisdiction to order such actions and saying that his plight should not stand in the way of the Trump administration's greater foreign policy goals. In a post on X, Vice President J.D. Vance defended the deportation, claiming that Mr. Abrego Garcia was a convicted MS-13 gang member with no legal right to be here. His lawyers have rejected any suggestion that he was in a gang member. We've not in the media seen evidence that he was. It is claimed by one side, not by another. Leave us discuss, I think, first with our immigration attorney, Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, this is not unique to the Trump administration. First of all, I just want to say this happens every day in America, all the time. Withholding of removal is the least settled immigration status. We have nearly unrestricted discretion to the Attorney General by design in the statute and by extension, the Department of Homeland Security, CBP. These officers make decisions every day without the benefit of a very rudimentary understanding of immigration law and policy. I've regularly had to have conversations with Border Patrol and or Immigration and Customs Enforcement about their errors in either attempting to take a client into custody, taking a client into custody, or in detaining a client unlawfully and or deporting them. This is not new. The silver lining, this is where I get really cynical. After 20 years of being an immigration lawyer under five administrations and four presidents is the five states, the truth of the matter is that our system is so broken that this barely makes the news when Trump isn't president. And when he's president, people care. So the silver lining for immigration lawyers is that although we are being specifically targeted by presidential actions that say that we should be held under, you know, brought up under disbarment and ethical ethical hearings for our conduct representing immigrants. That is not the silver lining. That's the dark part. The silver lining of that is that people care again about immigrants, which really was a struggle to get people to care. Even Democrats who were dealing with directly impacted constituents over the last 4 years. So I'm glad people care. But everyone should know that this happens all the time. All the time. I can't count on all my fingers and toes the numbers of people who had status who were actively being deported that I had to step in and assist.
I think 100%. I know that that's true and accurate. I think one thing that sets this apart is that the federal government is now paying millions of dollars to a foreign country to house these people in the most deplorable and egregious human rights violations. Prison cells.
There's always a difference under Trump. Thank you for highlighting that. Keep going. But yeah, under Trump, it's just so bad that it makes the news.
Right. And, yeah. And you know, a facility that has hundreds of deaths affiliated with it, yep. In just, you know, in months, over months of time, not decades of time. Right. So, I think the difference is we have sent a person away. We are paying for their incarceration in a foreign country in a place where we expect the person to not survive, mm-hmm. with their life. And then we're saying, oopsies. Mm-hmm. But we're going to keep paying and we will allow it to continue to likely end his life.
Although
what comes forward.
I will say that there's a distinction without a difference in that for asylum seekers, it's essentially the same thing. When we deport an asylum seeker to a country that they are specifically targeted in, they die. And so it is different that it's systemic. I mean, there's a lot of things.
In a cage and one's not in a cage.
No. The other one who's not in a cage is also dead because their attacker found them because there are tons of cases. I've been obsessed with one for a long time, the case of Maria S., who said that she would, if she were deported, that her abuser would kill her. He knew exactly where she was. I think he was a police officer. He had some kind of power and connections. She was literally in the
Which
border
country?
Zone. I cannot remember.
Okay, I'll look it up.
That's my trauma brain. And she told the ICE officer who was escorting her out of the country, I am going to die. And she was dead like four days later. So like it is different under the Trump administration because it's especially cruel. You know, the family separation policy, which they denied in the summer of 2018, which ultimately came to light as an official policy to deter migrants. They've shifted from deterrence to just outright, like, we need to grow our numbers. And that's where this is coming from. Another distinction that's very important is that ICE is canceling visas, including student visas, unilaterally. It doesn't cancel the status. It's important to know that. But they're removing the visas, which is the only proof that you have of whatever status you are conferred by the government. So it's especially cruel. It's especially terrible. And that's why it's the only silver lining, is in its cruelty, because then people care.
Either Bob.
Go ahead.
How did we get here? I feel like David Byrne on so many of these things. My God, how did we get here? How did we get to a situation where the migrant issue is so difficult, the status of people is so problematic? Because it's fine to sit here and say how bad it is, but it's like, how do we go back and figure out how this happened? Right. And what is so broken about our immigration policy? And then how does it get fixed? What's Congress's role? Right. We're talking about congressional oversight. I mean, the last president, I mean, was it W who tried to get an immigration bill passed? Right.
Well, it wasn't him. It was the Gang of Eight.
Yeah. OK. So, like, how do we solve this? Because this situation with Mr. Garcia is awful. And the thing with his family is totally tragic. Right. But unless we fix the whole thing, it's going to be collateral damage.
You're 1,000% right.
You mean let's talk historical context, and please correct me if I'm wrong. But I mean, go back to Reagan when we started to see the vilification of. I mean, you could go way back. I mean, we've vilified immigrants almost our entire history.
The very first law was called the Chinese Exclusion
Right.
Act.
Exactly. So
it's inherently racist.
It has been in definitely an issue in this country. I will also note that this is a failure of Congress to act, all right? That they have been unable and frankly unwilling to create the type of legislation that would bring clarity for folks that are looking to come to this country, folks that are looking to stay in this country, our business community. I mean, nobody knows what's going on right now with our immigration. I would also note that there was a bill which was passed under, you know, which was making its way through Congress that Trump put pressure on, particularly the House prior to the election. So that it was killed, and I had some serious concerns. I'm sure. You know, I would defer to Nick and Sarah on this about their concerns about, you know, Langford's bill. But at least it brought some clarity to the immigration situation. What really bothers, you know, when in addition to everything that's being said that I don't want to lose sight of is A, the tactics that are being used, the use of unmarked vehicles of tactical gear, grabbing people off the street, the idea that, oops, this is an administrative fault and there's nothing that we can do, that's garbage. And you know, in Bob's simple mind, this is a criminal activity that the agents and attorneys who are involved in this on behalf of the government should be charged criminally with. All right, that's Bob's opinion.
That's you, Bob, not me, Bob.
Right.
Just Bob, just, Bob just Griffin.
It's Bob's opinion. And again,
Bob Griffin called his own small brain Bob, small Bob brain, his own head.
No, I have one too, but these I just wanted own. To make
yeah.
sure
no.
that was.
No, I mean, we're talking about. There are so many issues that are linked with this, and the idea that, you know, we're powerless to get this person back and fix this. To fix this mistake, to fix this it's critical that we do make a stink about this and we fix it, because these administrative mistakes, if they get away with it, I have no faith that it's not going to continue, and eventually it's not going to be administrative mistakes around immigration. It will just be disappearing of people. This is how it starts.
I mean, it's there have been a lot of problems. In 1996, there was the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act passed under President Clinton and Democrats. And it was one of the most damaging pieces of immigration, quote unquote, reform for immigrants in America, followed up by W, who, after 9/11, abolished the INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, and turned it into a new agency, which is the Department of Homeland Security. Most people don't realize the Department of Homeland Security is only a couple decades old, right? And then, baked into the statute is that the Attorney General has unrestricted power. And this has been for a long time. The Attorney General has nearly unchecked and unrestricted power when it comes to immigration. And the immigration judiciary is not an independent judiciary. It is right under the Department of Justice. It is in the executive branch. There is a DOJ seal above the judges. So when you appear as an immigration attorney, you're up against a DOJ judge, quote unquote, and then you are your opposing counsel is from the Department of Homeland Security. There is no planet in which you are an immigration attorney and you're not against the government.
And to add to that, let's be honest about it. We have never funded, we have never put the bodies in place to even address a tenth of the workload. So again, this is another example of the games that get played and the games that are going to be played at the entire federal government level of, oh, I'm sorry, we can't implement the laws that are in place because we don't have the people. Again, these are choices that are being made, and Congress is going along with it, and the executive branch is going along with it. It's a game that denies people even the basic access to their rights by claiming that there aren't enough administrative immigration judges.
And the bottom line is we did that. I mean, we can yell at Congress all we want, but we elect them.
We do.
And every election cycle, immigration becomes a divisive topic. We allow it. We allow them to lead us to believe that our neighbors are our enemies, that the people who come to our churches, that play with our children, that, you know, and I shouldn't even say our, that we are divided, period. And they allow we allow that to happen with the messages. And then we think, oh, maybe this is dangerous. Maybe I can't, you know, trust the
person
next
door. But Sarah, look at the character assassination that's occurring by the vice president of the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, basically saying, don't, you know, just ignore this. It's a gang member.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know, again, oh, they're eating cats
but
and dogs.
But that's the dehumanizing.
It is the dehumanizing. But people just need to understand is that this is all part of the way the government is operating right now. You yeah. can't trust the government.
Well, I do think, and back to the silver lining starting point, that we are seeing this elevation of attacks on our college campuses, and I do think that that is going to ignite a very strong response. We have they started with deporting people for protesting a war, and there was some level of comfort in some pockets around that concept, even though, as Sarah mentioned in a break, that we had no problem with Proud Boys shouting anti-Jewish slogans with tiki torches and other Sarah
on the campus,
on
of
campus
UVA.
As well. And there's no conversation comparing those two scenarios. But, you know, locally and across the country, students with just regular visas are having student visas revoked with the intention of removing those students. They've paid thousands of out-of-state tuition. They have contributed to the communities on their campuses and in the communities where those campuses are housed and located. And I don't know that we've ever had a national conversation around whether we have any discomfort with college students coming from abroad. And like, that's a new topic that is going, I think, to escalate the immigration debate in a uniquely Trump era way.
I really hope so. But what was really devastating, and this is why I can't practice immigration law anymore, when ProPublica released the tape of the children, the babies who were separated from their parents in the summer of 2018 crying for their mothers, and it received nationwide attention, what changed. If those babies crying out for their parents didn't move us as Americans, this is why we need Cory Booker. It was a sermon. It wasn't a singularly or solely performative act. It was a call to return to our values.
But I think the problem and what is changing now is that it's my next door neighbor. It's my, you know, not my kids, but like my kids' classmates. It's, I mean, they're in our public schools, they're on campuses locally in upstate New York in a space where we think we live in a bubble that's safe from, you know, Southern politics, Bible Belt politics, where like it's this othering sense that there's like this safety in upstate New York that doesn't exist. And I think this administration is executing a demonstration that you're not safe anywhere by, you know, attacking doctors who are in New York for sending abortion pills or advice for abortion in other states. They're piercing that sense of safety in a way that I don't think blue state voters have ever had to grapple with, and they are going to have to grapple with it now. And I think it's interesting as like a political nerd who's just kind of nerding out in a detached way. I think it is a new thing.
But go ahead, Bob.
I was going to say, it's interesting you mentioned the safety thing. I just want to make two points. Sarah, I really appreciate you mentioning that this is a thing that's gone back almost 30 years of the ultimate reluctance of our elected officials to grapple with the immigration issue, right? Mario Cuomo used to say a brilliant thing, which is sometimes politicians would rather have the issue than the solution. Yeah. And I think that is a bipartisan failure, right? Democratic presidents, Republican presidents, they'd rather have the issue than the solution, because the issue is real easy. It's a soundbite. Resolving problems is really complicated, right? So it's just easier to go good, bad, right? Yep. Than figure something out. The second point is, Nick, you mentioned safety. I'm with you on these are people in our churches, these are people in our neighborhoods, these are people we know, those are people we like. But my father's off the boat. Okay, you know, legal immigration in the 30s.
Which was before a majority of the immigration laws that exist today existed at all.
Yeah, I mean, the concept of legal immigration is a false narrative.
It's literally walking off the boat. Yeah.
Well, let's put it this way. It wasn't illegal.
But it wasn't different.
Well, a separate point is the case that the very legitimate case you want to make is damaged by things like gangs in the city and human trafficking that is being done by some percentage of the people coming in over the border, right, without any kind of regulation.
My favorite thing is the Cato Institute, and you probably didn't expect me to say that because the Cato Institute is a libertarian, right-leaning Heritage Foundation, Federalist Society Club member. And
well, they're more libertarian than left or right.
Yep.
Yeah.
They regularly issue statistical analyses proving with social science that when immigrants move into or when the more immigrants you have in your neighborhoods, the lower the crime rates are. The vast majority of terror attacks in this country have been committed by white men. This is the problem. These are the messages we are soaking up out of fear to just say, oh, well, maybe I should think about that. No, you shouldn't. It's false. It's demonstrably false to point to immigrants and crime and link them together, except that's intentional because you're right. Politicians have done that when it's convenient for them. And that was illustrated when Eric Adams unilaterally and sometimes without consent put people on buses that were immigrants, shuttled them up to four hotels in upstate New York, just four in our area alone. There were way more than that. And county executives, including Democrats, said, not in my backyard. I can't handle it. This issue is beyond repair until we demand it. We can't say somebody fix this for us.
Yeah. You can't argue statistics to overcome people's perceptions.
You can if it's the truth, and you can. You're a message guy. What's the message?
You
it's
take the
not...
message, right? But the message has to be correct. And like the fact is, the majority of victims of human trafficking are trafficked for work other than sex exploitation, but we think of human trafficking victims as gang-related sex exploitation, and that's a false narrative. And the problem is we have the studies, we have the data, but in our psyche as a country, we think we allow the thought that that immigrants are related to gangs and human sex trafficking. And that's it's just not accurate. And we have to change how we are presenting facts and be accurate and factual in our arguments around immigration. And when we turn to those facts, we know that immigration actually improves and enhances economic activity and has a multiplier effect on local economies and improves many aspects of communities in a myriad of ways, just statistically speaking, even if you don't like or don't appreciate that level of diversity.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Our panel this morning, Bob Bellafiore, Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, and Sarah Rogerson. We will return with more after this news break from the BBC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, here with communications expert and founder and president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson. The email address to join the conversation, should you care to do so, is panel@wamc.org. This from the AP. Democratic-backed candidate for the Wisconsin Supreme Court defeated a challenger endorsed by President Donald Trump and billionaire Elon Musk on Tuesday. She touted her victory as a win against powerful interests and cementing a liberal majority for at least three more years. Susan Crawford, a Dane County judge who led legal fights to protect union power and abortion rights and opposes voter ID, stood on stage surrounded by the court's four current liberal justices and celebrated her win as a victory for democracy while also taking a dig at Musk, rather. Growing up in Chippewa Falls, she said, "I never could have imagined I'd be taking on the richest man in the world for justice in Wisconsin. And we won." Musk and groups he backed spent more than $21 million in an effort to defeat Crawford. He even traveled to Wisconsin 2 days before the election to personally hand over $1 million checks to two voters. Discuss. Who wants to start?
I'm not an expert in election law in Wisconsin, but I am trying to wrap my brain around sort of the method, like the legality or the ethical
ramifications,
the questionable ethics around, paying voters, and I'm really curious, like, what the analysis is going to be on the activity engaged in by Elon Musk in that election, and like how I guess the question is how did that happen, but I think generally it is a really good sign for Democrats that they were able to overcome such a tremendous flood of funding for Susan's opponent. And I think it does bode well for that court and for that region's courts to keep a Democratic or a liberal leaning majority on that bench.
The person she defeated, since we didn't name them, Crawford defeated Republican backed Brad Scheimel, in a race that broke records for spending and was the highest turnout Wisconsin Supreme Court election ever, and has become, you know, a proxy fight for the nation's political battles.
Yeah, I thought you were going to go in a different place, because I have sort of mixed feelings about the electing judges.
Yes.
And the politicalization of it, and it's hard for me to imagine that my $25 donation is going to carry the same benefit of a doubt from judges as the $25 million, you know, my $25 versus his $25 million. And I do worry, again, that this is a prime example of further deterioration of our electorate
because of
the amount of money in elections right now. But this is the system. Yeah. This is the system that they have. And I could have made a compelling case in the past that this is putting the judiciary closer to the people, you know, that it removes politicians from it. I would be careful about extrapolating this as a beginning of a wave of anti-Trump, anti-Musk. It's one point. There were also two elections yesterday in Florida, both of which went to return Republicans to seats that had been Republican before. I will note that Randy Fine, who now is a member of Congress who has the most porn name in politics, was a very flawed candidate, but he still won by 14%. And sort of the spin on this is that Trump won by 32%, so we're seeing a reduction. And again, I'd be careful about extrapolating, you know, using these elections as an example of what's occurring across the country.
But I think Wisconsin is interesting, specifically the state of Wisconsin, because they recently voted to legalize abortion, right, in a state that, like, I think on the coasts, we don't have the same – we make a lot of assumptions about – the center of the country, and we're seeing a shift in some of those states. And I think Wisconsin is like a really interesting microcosm of what that shift looks like.
Well, this is how the Trump Musk machine works. So Elon Musk has a case for his business, Tesla, against the Wisconsin state government. So he has – it may ultimately be heard by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So he has a personal vested interest in this. So that's only part of the question about why Wisconsin, though, and why Brad Scheimel, who is the former attorney general of the state of Wisconsin, who was very vocal about pushing slow-walking rape test kits and pushing an abortion ban. So it was like a win-win for the Musk-Trump team, because Musk's like personal corporate interests were involved. But then also you have Scheimel, who's sort of like a golden boy for Trump policies, who also was endorsed by the NRA Political Victory Fund. So he had the trifecta. He was like guns and you know, women's bodies, and, you know, like he's
capitalism.
A Trump guy.
He also plays bass in a classic rock cover band, and that we don't hold against him. It's fine.
No, that's fine.
but it's a weird situation to be where you know, growing up was always justice is blind, right? The idea of the scales, and it feels like all we're doing is voting people in where we know how the decision is going to be made, which leaves me both uncomfortable, but I understand the politics of it. And I also note that the redistricting is a huge issue in Wisconsin about the gerrymandering of districts that was being done by the Republican legislature, and that case is also making its way forward. The abortion case, I think, is also interesting because it's the total ban on abortion would be based off of a law from 1849. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's a lot of interesting case law that is going before the court.
It is very different because it's not like the Democrats that are running against these really well-funded Republicans are, you know, not that I have anything against their policies, but Bernie or AOC Democrats. They don't represent the left or leftist most part of the Democratic Party. They're really centrist. This is just how far off course we've gotten that we have to course correct to like barely the middle.
And I would note just on the like politics in the judiciary, that position has a 10-year term. So there is stability in the bench once the nonpartisan election is over. And I think that is helpful in thinking about how impactful somebody's political affiliation is or how much money somebody donated to them 5 years later when this new case comes up. I just think that the longer term period gives them some independence.
Bob Bellafiore.
I don't know how it could. If there's you know, politicians have what they used to derisively call Irish Alzheimer's, which is to forget everything except the slights. And it would seem to me that judicially, that ethically, the winner of this seat would have to recuse herself in any case that involved Elon Musk or any of his business interests, because he spends so much money to defeat her. And that, and there is no statute of limitations on grudges.
I mean, that's not how recusals work, but
If somebody spent money against you, I mean, you have to be conflicted.
Or for you, she could just follow the Clarence Thomas rules of ethics. Just noting.
The second point is there's no perfect way to appoint judges. Bob, I'm with you. I hate the fact that there are political campaigns in New York 50 years ago eliminated the election of judges to the Court of Appeals for that very reason. But then we saw a couple of years ago.
But we don't have a problem with the Court of Appeals. Interesting. We actually have a pretty balanced Court of Appeals.
Well, hold on a sec. But I'm going to get to that point. A couple of years ago, there was a vacancy, and Governor Hochul nominated a fairly moderate center-of-the-road justice that the Senate Democrats railroaded because they needed a swing vote on redistricting. And instead, they kicked out Hector LaSalle and instead confirmed a judge who thought an elephant in a zoo should be able to sue for human rights. And they put this judge in because he was with their program on redistricting. So even, you know, New York, you think you had no problem with New York, but for partisan reasons, the Democrats who control the state Senate railroaded a moderate and put in their guy who would do their thing on their most important issue.
I think that's one take, but there's lots of other takes that are maybe more comprehensive to the like global political situation of the moment, which included just, some some political malpractice by the political malpractice of like the Hochul administration at the time. I think there were other tools that if she had used those other tools to negotiate with the Senate majority, that they would have had a different outcome. And
she shouldn't have signed off on their pay raise before they did this.
I mean, there's that exactly, right? But, I mean, there's lots of things. I think there was just
appointments are messy too.
Major gap in communication between the executive and the legislature that like caused the sort of cascade of events to happen that I think she lost control over. But
the fact of the matter is the Senate Democrats wanted a judge who was going to do what they wanted on their single most important issue, which is their election viability and the maintenance of their majority, right? It was a very smart move by then. But the person they put in there thought an elephant should be able to sue for human rights. And I don't know what kind of jurist that is. With a 70-something page dissent.
I'm not sure that that's
I don't think
accurate.
That's exactly true. But
I will say that the Democratic overreach in New York State by the party here has been harmful to the party itself, for sure. I mean, like, that has happened on occasion. Just like Republican overreach in the state of New York has come around to bite it itself. I mean, we look no further than McLaughlin. Look no further than, you know, there are a lot of examples of Republicans making mistakes in terms of who they choose and who they elevate in New York State that undercut their agenda, as it stated. There are plenty. Senator Ashby is a Republican that I would lift up as somebody that I respect way more.
I mean, I think it's just endemic. Like, the parties are not a monolithic entity, and there's a lot of variety in opinions and positions and motivations across the spectrum, and like the idea that they just are always in lockstep in any party is just not accurate and is never going to play out that way.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. It is time for our final underwriting break of the morning, and then we will return with another segment taking the show up to the top of the hour. The email address again, panel@WAMC.org, and we'll return after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Our panelists this morning, Bob Bellafiore, Bob Griffin, Nick Rangel, and Sarah Rogerson. I'm Sarah LaDuc in for Joe Donahue, who is observing a scheduled day off and should return tomorrow. Let us discuss the United States health agencies and recent actions happening there. This is from the Washington Post. Top officials of the National Institute of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration were put on administrative leave or offered reassignment to the Indian Health Service. Other employees began receiving layoff notices or learned that they had lost their jobs when their entry badges no longer worked on Tuesday morning. At one HHS office in Rockville, Maryland, long lines grew as workers were screened to determine whether or not they were still employed. At the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, some employees who were laid off were told to contact Anita Pinder, former director of the Office of Equal Opportunity and Civil Rights. She passed away last year. In a late Tuesday afternoon post online, that's yesterday afternoon, RFK wrote, "This overhaul is about realigning Health and Human HHS with its core mission to stop chronic disease epidemic and make America healthy again. It's a win-win for taxpayers and for every American we serve. The number of people who lost their jobs was difficult to ascertain because many of the staff who would know were dismissed. HHS last week projected it would lay off about 10,000 people in addition to the 10,000 who took buyouts or retirement offers. Yesterday, it became clear that the move encompasses a broad swath of expertise, biomedical scientists, staff who respond to freedom of information requests, and researchers who work to improve patient safety. What had not been anticipated was that senior leaders would also be removed through the administrative leave process or by proposed transfers. Some received letters that offered reassignment to agencies in remote locations like Alaska or Billings, Montana." The job cuts came just days after RFK Jr. vowed to make health agencies to focus on safe, wholesome food, clean water, and the elimination of environmental toxins. RFK Jr. also said on Thursday in a video address that the agency would do more with less. "No American is going to be left behind," he assured. Tuesday's layoffs continue weeks of tumult in the health agencies, where a large number of federal grants have been cut and hundreds of research projects paused or slated for cancellation. Who would like to speak first?
I'll start.
Bob Griffin.
I need to make a plug again for what our federal workforce was. These are highly trained specialists, often working in getting compensated well below what their expertise is. They are many of these are singular experts, global experts in areas that keep us safe. And the wholesale destruction of this workforce, it sets back our nation and our national security forever, right? Because if you know, the folks that I'm talking to down there, including some folks over at HHS, they are turning their back on government service, and frankly, I cannot blame them for that. The question that the listeners need to start asking our congressional representatives is, who benefits from this? Right? Who benefits from the fact that our food is not going to be as safe, or our drugs are not going to be as safe, or the fact that we're not doing research in areas like cancer or Alzheimer's? Who benefits from this? Because that garbage about we're going to do more with less, that's playing into the old trope that lazy federal workers. These are not lazy federal workers. These are experts, and they're people who have been dedicated to this country. RFK Jr. should never have been confirmed, and he is carrying out Project 2025. And again, Sarah, it's not just about implementing this vision for a smaller government. It is destroying whenever possible the bastions that could question the authority of Trump and his oligarchs. This is what it really comes down to, is that they're taking away the people. They're eliminating the people who could question what they're doing and how they're doing it and hold them accountable. And whether it's at the university system, like we talked about, whether it's with the immigration, whether it's with the research, with the federal workforce, this is all designed to make it so that government is not going to be in a position to hold these people accountable for the crimes they're committing.
Including the e-cigarette industry, who apparently had approvals backlogged, and all the people overseeing that are gone. including pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, that's feeding into this because the FDA has been gutted. So drug approvals will have less oversight. There is cuts in funding for addiction recovery, substance abuse. It's hard to come up with if this were surgical. If this were, we're going to get rid of quote-unquote government waste, or if we're going to, you know, look for people who, quote-unquote, aren't doing their jobs, that would be one thing. That's not what this is. They pretended that's what it was. I mean, what was the three question? You know, tell me three things you did about your job that Elon— Five things you did last week, right? So that was performative because that was intended to say, oh, look over here, we're making government better. And instead, we're going to take out these, like, really long-standing public servants who do their jobs every day to keep us all safe from things like, you know, pandemics and bird flu, which apparently RFK Jr. doesn't care about either. Didn't he say, like, let's let all the chickens get the bird flu and, you know, we'll just let them naturally work it through their ecosystem? Like, this is nuts.
Well, I mean, I agree that it's obviously this is very bonkers. But I think there's like two kind of interesting pieces. I do think that the end game is to privatize more of our government systems and to not to save the government money, but to spend it elsewhere in a way that generates profit instead of has the public interest in mind. So all of those people, and I think Elon Musk said this at some point, like, why, like, you should go get a private job. Like, you should take your skills and not be wasting them away for public interest, and you should, like, go make some real money somewhere. And I'm paraphrasing.
It's probably pretty close.
The other piece that I think is going to be kind of interesting is, like, if we don't have an agency that has public trust to approve pharmaceuticals, who's going to buy them? Like, what insurance carrier is going to approve your prescription for a medication that has not been tested in any public space or any health experts? What foreign country is going to import our pharmaceuticals if they don't have anything to rely on as evidence that it's what it says it is? And I think we're creating for ourselves this, like, very strange conundrum around, like, why do we have government experts? What is their value? And what do we miss out on when we eliminate that expertise from public service?
Yeah. A little under 3 minutes left in the show. I want to point out, but I do want to, of course, hear from Bob Bellafiore before we go.
Yeah. My attitude is I'm going to take a wait and see. I certainly believe there are more. The question is, how will the most essential services of government get carried out with fewer people? I firmly believe you can do this with fewer people. And I experienced this when George Pataki took office in 1995 and I was his press secretary. Whenever you try to cut the budget, the conversation turns to the intent of the program and not the results of the program. So are these roles, and is the current organization of these departments actually working? If you want to say kept us safe from a pandemic, I don't think the after action view of how the U.S. dealt with COVID is going to be real complimentary. And you want to talk about suppressing alternative points of view and keeping the government accountable. What happened to people who tried to say that COVID was a lab leak? They got suppressed. They got shut out. Their social media platforms got censored. So it's not exactly like we had robust, free speaking watchdogs going on during the biggest pandemic in 100 years in this country. So what are we talking about? So
well, what we weren't doing was firing all of those people. We weren't firing them.
No, the
second floor of your house is on fire. Let's just wait and see if it affects the kitchen. Okay, I got it.
Wait. Everything you're talking about is speculation. I mean,
So aren't you? It's all speculation.
Well, right. We're the peanut gallery. Mm-hmm. So, I'm gonna before I make any judgment, I'm gonna wait and see. You know, are things actually getting handled with a smaller government? This is not to dismiss your friends, Bob, who I know lots of people who lose their jobs all the time in government and in the private sector. So me, it's just like, let's just wait and see what happens.
I mean, I can see an argument that there could be some cuts in spending, but that's not what we're doing, actually. We are eliminating the, like, 80%, 90% of our core governmental functions, things that we need. But we're also not saving dollars. And there's a real disconnect there.
Thank you all for participating in the Peanut Gallery this morning. I appreciate you. The panel will be posted online at wamc.org/roundtable a little bit after 11, I believe, is when Maddie gets it up there. Thank you to her. Thank you for listening. Joe will return tomorrow.